Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Why do humans make art? Why, since the dawn of man, everywhere around the world have we sung, painted, sculpted, told stories? Philosopher Dennis Dutton believes that it hasn't just been uplifting or fun. He believes it's bred in the bone, that for humans, art is a piece of evolution. An evolved instinct essential to our development and survival. Read Anna Karenina, gaze on the Chrysler Building, hear Mozart, he says, and you're part of an evolutionary story. This hour, On Point, philosopher Dennis Dutton on humans, evolution, and art. You can join the conversation. Does it ring true to you? Art as essential to human evolution, as elemental as our opposable thumb. Would we have been humans without it, have surmounted saber-toothed tigers? Joining me now from Christchurch, New Zealand, is Dennis Dutton, professor of the philosophy of art at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. He's widely known as co-founder and co-editor of the website Arts and Letters Daily. His new book is The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. Dennis Dutton, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. Make your case. What's new here? We know art's important. You're saying it's more than important. It's what?
Well, it's important in some people's lives. It isn't all that important. I don't want to overrate the importance of art. I just want to talk, I suppose, initially about three things. There are three aspects of art which cry out for some kind of evolutionary explanation. First is that the arts give people intense pleasures. Some of the most profound pleasures in life can come from art. I don't want to say that there aren't other things, sexual pleasure, the pleasure of watching your children grow up, the pleasures of sociality. But in there, with the top pleasures, the arts certainly stand, whether it's music or painting or poetry, you know, name your favorite art. Mm. Pleasure's there, and pleasure is normally some kind of a hallmark of an evolved trait. Universality. The arts exist everywhere. The arts exist all over the world, and they travel through cultures. It's not as though every culture has its own specific art, which is culturally only understood by it. Brazilians love Japanese prints. Beethoven is adored in Korea. The Chinese love Shakespeare. The way in which the arts travel through history, so we can actually read Homer and think about arts that were made hundreds of years ago, and they can move us today. They move through history and they move across cultures. That's some kind of a hallmark of a phenomenon that requires a general human explanation. And finally, spontaneity. They spontaneously arise in people's lives in cultures around the world. Think of, for example, children and make-believe play. Children, at a very early age, in most sophisticated ways, understand storytelling, understand make-believe. And, of course, that's the basis, really, of fiction and a lot of the arts, is some sense of make-believe. I think that, actually, the way to understand this is not simply to do what's gone on in universities for the last 40 years. Everything's culture. It's all culture. Unique cultures have unique art forms, and you have to understand them culturally. That is certainly half the story. There's no doubt about it. And there's a lot of truth in saying that. But underneath that, there's something which is different than culture. There's something which is in our genes, which is innate, which gives the human personality the sense that we have of what human beings are. A human charm, human wit, the way that human beings can arrange their lives in social relations with each other, these are in part Darwinian adaptations. And it's that Darwinian underpinning that I want to get at in my book, The Art Instinct.
Let's begin to do that. People hear evolution, of course, they think of Darwin. Put this in a Darwinian context for us. Is your thinking as a philosopher fitting into or built around his conception of evolution?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Darwin thought that evolution wasn't simply about how our internal organs evolved, or, as you mentioned, the opposable thumb or our binocular vision. or the our upright gait and the body itself. He also thought that the human personality evolved. He thought that it was a part of our Pleistocene heritage. I mean, we're talking here about the 1.6, 1.8 million years that takes us up to the modern age. If we just sort of assume, and it might be in many ways a dodgy assumption, but if we assume that evolution stopped about 10,000 years ago, the 1.6 million years, which is 80,000 generations, it's an unimaginably long time, that's the period in which we became human. If you went back and found your ancestors at the beginning of the Pleistocene, that 1.6 million year period, and you met them on the street, you'd call the zoo and, you know, try to get tranquilizer guns out and capture them so they didn't get hurt or walk into traffic. At the end of the Pleistocene, you know, they're us. They're simply, you know, if you call the Border Patrol maybe, or Immigration and Naturalization, but they are us. And it's that period in which we became human. That's where you have the great cave paintings in Lascaux. That's where you have the hand axes. That's where you have the development of the arts. But what I'm doing as a philosopher isn't what other people have done, and that is to say, find out as much as you can about Pleistocene artistic practices or Ice Age art, and then predict the future. What I'm doing is looking at the arts worldwide today, to look at literature, to look at oral arts, to look at dancing and music as it exists all over the world today, as it gives people pleasure today, and do what the evolutionary psychologists call reverse engineering. To reverse engineer, well, what would have had to be the case in order for us to have this intense involvement with the arts that we have today? You know, we explain food with evolutionary psychology. We explain sex with evolutionary psychology. Why not our intense involvement with the arts?
So do some reverse engineering for us right now here. Time travel with us then. If you take that perspective and you go very deep back into time, what role do you see arts having played, natural selection, sexual selection, origin of the species? How do you imagine having played out in the Pleistocene era?
Well, I think that along with the big brain that was produced in the Pleistocene, which is the brain that we have today, came imagination. And I would say number one, the most important thing that I would think about the arts is, if you look at something like storytelling, the survival value that accrued to any hunter-gatherer group that could not only simply imagine game on the other side of the hill, or what happened last week, or plan about what's going to happen next season, what you have is an ability to invent and understand as fictional all sorts of complicated narratives. I mean, you could engage yourself in war games in the sense that you are worried about defending yourself against some other hunter-gatherer group that might be threatening to you. Or it's a matter of planning for food gathering or for hunting expeditions. Imagination, the ability to imagine and to derive pleasure from imagination, which makes it even more attractive and exercises the brain more and perhaps builds it up more, I think is one of the most important cornerstones of the art, cornerstones of storytelling, in the extent that that's one of the most important arts. And I think that would have had great survival value in the Pleistocene. Again, it's pleasurable. You know, there was a study that came out a couple of years ago, and it was a British study, but I think it probably applies to all the industrialized countries, including the U.S., that the average British adult spends 6% of all waking life involved with fictional stories, watching them on television, reading them in magazines and so forth. I think that actually, that survey left out books. But if you just look at the amount of time in terms of films and television that people watch, people are heavily involved with fiction. The fiction goes all the way from Tolstoy, you know, to Harlequin romances.
But your claim here is in a way that we wouldn't have been human without it, that our evolutionary path itself fundamentally was shaped by, among other things, this capacity to spin out fiction, imagine what's over the hill, what might be coming in a war scenario or a, I don't know, a herding scenario, and that made us what we are.
It made us what we are. I mean, you have to, you can't say that it makes us human, because I think we could have been human without, for example, our love of music or without our love of fiction. It's just that we wouldn't be human in the sense that we know it. You know, what we are today, we are people who love, for example, music. We like ornamented use of language. We like humor. We love jokes. There are certain sort of a list of factors that, you know, I would just sort of generally call charm, which is what makes the human personality what it is. These are evolved traits. These came through, not through natural selection, but in my opinion, as I argue in the book, through sexual selection.
I wonder sexual if selection. We really yeah. would have been human, if it's an instinct, if it's evolutionary, would we really have been human about it? We've got that question and about a million more here. Dennis Dutton, philosopher. His new book is The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. He joins us today from Christchurch, New Zealand. He teaches, is a professor at the University of Canterbury in Christchurch. We'll go out with a little Mendelssohn. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about art and evolution. My guest today says the human love of art is Darwinian, that it was key to letting humans survive and thrive. Philosopher Dennis Dutton joins us. He's the author of the new book, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. Dennis Dutton, let me begin to bring in our art-loving human population, Laurie, in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm interested in this
topic. Laurie.
If, you know, our development of art and literature and all that was just another form of display. I have read that peacocks, you know, the male peacocks develop those huge feathers in the back that actually keep them from being able to fly. They're kind of a negative, but the positive of being able to attract a hen with your great big feathers outweighs that negative. And I just wonder if it was all about, you know, impressing a mate with this pleasurable ability to draw, and it was just something that was kind of a display that got you ahead in the mating game that eventually turned into something more.
Laurie, hold that question for just a moment. And Dennis Dutton, it's interesting, you're getting all kinds of exposure with this, Professor, including on the Colbert Report recently, and you had in a way the same question from Colbert. Here it is, going to the heart of Laurie's question.
You have said that art is a way, is a tool for propagating, right?
Yeah.
So is everybody doing art just to get laid?
Well,
is that really what it's all about? Because that's what I suspect.
They could be rock stars of all ages. Uh-huh. You know, rock stars of all ages might fit that description.
Uh-huh.
Dennis Dutton, there you are with Stephen Colbert. What about Laurie's inquiry?
I think Laurie's got a great question. I have an answer. It's the whole of chapters, I think, 7 and 8.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, sexual display certainly has something to do with the arts. Of course, in an animal sexual display, it's not really conscious. Those poor peacocks who are growing these huge tails are doing so really because they genetically can't help it, and they genetically can't help it because peahens for generations, for thousands of peacock generations and peahen generations, have been choosing peacocks with the biggest tails. So they're dragging these things around whether they like it or not. When we get to human beings, we're rather at a different conscious level where people do like to captivate the attention of one another, are interested in showing off for each other, and that there, I think that a lot of the show-off aspects of the art, the wasteful, exuberant, extravagant, glittering aspects of the art, which are part of the whole arts as show, surely has some basis in human sexual selection. Sexual selection is a part of Darwinian evolution, not just for peacocks, but for human beings as well. Human beings do like to charm and impress one another. And if you go through the lists that have been done of mating criteria across the world, they're quite uniform across cultures. Again, this is gives a lie to this idea that it's all simply a cultural construction. I mean, women do like witty men. Men do like curvaceous women. Women do like men with resources, with money of some kind. They tend to like older men. Men like also women who are witty somehow, who can you know, use their wiles and their charm. And
so,
I think this is all part
about,
of an evolutionary picture.
What does it say about art?
What it says is that the arts are themselves emblems or signs of sexual display, sometimes of wastefulness. The arts are over the top. They're actually far more than you can explain with natural selection, and the very wastefulness in itself, like, as Laurie said, the peacock's tail, is actually produced by sexual selection. It's produced as a way of one sex impressing the other. Now, I don't think this is just sexual display. I mean, Beethoven is not writing the late quartets as sexual display. He's writing them because he's fascinated by the musical problems that are implicit in them. But when we look back into prehistory, where all this stuff came from, surely the show-off aspects of sexual display are part of it, as they're part of sports and the rest of social life as well.
Laurie, how do you see it? The arts as the peacock tail of human mating dynamics?
Well, just the aspect that is interesting is that, you know, the peacock's tail doesn't serve any functional, practical purpose, and neither does art. But we tend to say now that that's what actually makes art so worthwhile, is that it doesn't have a practical application.
Exactly.
Art for art's sake. Yeah.
Right.
It's like something you could only evolve over time if you're a human.
Laurie, thank you very much for your call. Dennis Dutton, really no functional purpose? I mean, evolution seems all about functionality, ultimately, even if it comes around in unexpected ways, that functionality.
Well, that functionality is for survival in the case of natural selection and reproduction. But in sexual selection, where, for example, with birds, you have birds that evolve songs or that evolve plumage and feathers that are colored in a way that actually perhaps makes the male of the species, if it's a male-female distinction, more visible in the wild and actually goes, as Laurie said, against natural selection. What you have is a problem here. In fact, you know, Darwin himself, after he published The Origin of Species, said that he'd solved the problem of the eye and the evolution of the eye and the origin of the species. He said, now whenever I look at a peacock's tail, he wrote this to Asa Gray, who was in Boston at that time. He said, now whenever I look at a peacock's tail, it makes me sick. And what he meant by that was he had a problem to explain the peacock's tail. Well, I think the problem he had to explain the peacock's tail is the problem that anybody has who wants to explain the extraordinary, extravagant, wasteful nature of the arts and nevertheless their centrality in human life and evolution. They're everywhere.
You know,
and that's part of what we like about the arts. We actually like the wastefulness of them.
It raises a question there. You said earlier you thought we could have, would have evolved as humans without the arts. But if they're part of sexual selection, at least for some part of the species, how could that be? If they're part of sexual selection, they're part of what we have become, preferences that are now innate, wouldn't they be? I mean, we really wouldn't be.
Oh, I completely agree. I just meant, of course, we would have been a different species. We might have come about, but we would have been grad grinds. We would have been people who didn't care about imagination. I mean, it really is strange, isn't it? When you just think about fiction, in the Pleistocene, people had to make adzes, and they had to sharpen them.
Mm-hmm.
And no one had any interest in an adz or making an adz that wasn't sharp, I mean, because it's a functional tool.
Mm-hmm.
If fiction or if storytelling is a functional tool, why are we not as averse to fictions as we would be to dull tools? You know, you could say if natural selection controlled human evolution, we ought to have evolved to dislike fiction as we dislike rotted food or tools that don't cut. But we actually enjoy fiction because there was more benefit from being able in the Pleistocene to think imaginatively, wildly imaginatively sometimes. It drew societies together, and it made it possible for people to get far more productive use of the brain and applying it to the world.
We're going to get an anthropologist's view of our philosopher's hypothesis here in a moment. Let's get another call first. Tom in Somerville, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Dennis Dutton.
Hi. So my issue comes from reading an article in the New York Times Magazine sometime back by someone, I think James Carroll, who wrote an article about evolutionary literary criticism. Mm-hmm. And he made a number of points about Jane Austen, talking about how Austen's novels basically teach people to allocate their resources properly. And what the problem I had with this was that essentially the conclusion you came to, if you followed these critics, was that the meaning of the novel boils down to the evolutionary success of the strategy. And that seems like a problem for me. It means that instead of looking at art from inside the art and experiencing what it does in us in a genuine way, that we're looking from the outside with this distant clinical scientific viewpoint that reduces it and ruins it.
There's sort of the art lover's critique of your position, Dennis, and that it looks at art for a payoff, for an evolutionary kind of mercantilism.
I'm absolutely on Tom's side on this. I mean, any artistic theory that reduces art to some one-dimensional factor isn't worth really our attention. What we need is something that actually gives us a rich view of art. Now, in that particular case, I must say I much objected to the oversimplification of Joseph Carroll's position in the article in the New York Times that you're talking about. I know that. I think that article was a scandal because Carroll is one of the most acute literary critics I know who's writing today, and his work on Jane Austen is wonderfully astute and humane and deeply rich in the layering. He's an evolutionary critic who, of course, sees the evolutionary aspects, particularly of Jane Austen. I mean, she is the poet laureate of female choice, of sexual selection. Mm. Her novels involve fundamentally always this idea of female choice, which is part of the charm of them. But the idea that Carroll or anybody who's involved in evolutionary aesthetics is trying to just simply analyze all art in terms of a single payoff, well, that would be as bad as the Marxists who wanted to analyze all art in terms of some economic factor or capitalist oppression. I mean, I'm not saying that these ideas are always irrelevant, but what we have to have is an evolutionary aesthetics, which is what I've tried to do in this book, which is alive to the complexities and the human depth of art and doesn't try to reduce everything to one element.
Tom, thanks so much for your call. Let us bring one more Tom in here. Thomas Wynn joins us from Colorado Springs. He's professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, focuses on the evolution of human cognitive processes, i.e., thinking. He's co-author of the forthcoming book, The Rise of Homo Sapiens, The Evolution of Modern Thinking. Thomas Wynn, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello.
So as a kind of scientist looking on here at the philosopher's hypothesis, art as an instinct, art as elemental to human evolution, how do you respond, sir?
Well, one of the points Dr. Dutton made earlier I found very convincing as an anthropologist, and this is the universality of art. Everyone we know does it all over the world in all kinds of cultures, and that really a priori suggests that there's an evolutionary component to it. Now, some evolutionary scientists would argue that art is largely a side effect of the evolution of some other cognitive abilities. I, however, think that Dr. Dutton probably has a pretty good point here, that given the universality of art, that there is probably something coded in our genes somewhere which leans us in this direction.
Do you see evidence way back, a Pleistocene era, that might support that view?
Sure. But what I would like to do is sort of break it apart, being an archaeologist. Two things struck me about the first Laurie's question concerning display and sexual selection. Mm-hmm. I mean, an argument has been made for this based on early stone tools called hand axes that were manufactured initially about 1.5 million years ago, and by an ancestor of ours named Homo erectus. Mm-hmm. And Homo erectus continued to make these things for over 1 million years. And over this 1 million-year period, the only thing that really happens to them is that they look nicer and prettier over time. Mechanically, they don't get any more effective. They're really no more effective as butchery tools 500,000 years ago than they were 1 million years ago. And that's always been a puzzle, because if it's not the mechanical use of the tool, why is it getting prettier over time? Moreover, most of them that we find appear not to have been used at all. When we look for damage on the edges of the tools, the damage just isn't there. So an archaeologist named Stephen Mithen from the University of Reading has argued that hand axes were actually playing a role in sexual selection, that individuals who manufactured nice-looking hand axes were, in a sense, advertising, displaying their worth as a potential mate.
Wow.
This is a very controversial argument in archaeology, and I know a lot of my colleagues sort of scoff at it, but it has the real advantage in that it really explains some interesting things about hand axes that we have otherwise not been able to understand. So that's the first thing I wanted to point out. This idea of display may in fact go back a long way in human evolution in terms of the kinds of products that we produce. But the other point that puzzled me a little bit more was this argument about fiction storytelling and sort of lumping these things together. Speaking as an archaeologist, we can only probably argue back for that kind of behavior maybe 50,000 years, maybe only 30,000 years. We don't really have good evidence for that kind of imaginative storytelling or imaginative presentation until much, much later in human evolution. So I'm sort of interested in what Dr. Dutton has to say about this sort of disconnect chronologically in terms of what you might want to argue is an evolution of symmetrical or aesthetic sense in these very early hand axes, but evidence for fictional
the fiction side. Dennis Dutton, how about it? Dennis Dutton?
Oh, well, first I'd like to say something about hand axes. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with what Tom Wynn said about hand axes. I mean, they are still beautiful to us today to look at. The most extraordinary hand axes really are gorgeous. They're symmetrical, and the beauty of them is in part in the symmetry. They're often teardrop shaped, and it's the same teardrop shape you see in great diamonds and great diamond cuttings, and sometimes in earrings, and in other jewelry. The hand axes persisted for 1 million years. They are still beautiful to look at. It does look like they actually were some kind of display signal, that is to say, that made more likely than not by men for women, but that women were actually judging the manual ability, the planning ability, the access to resources, all of these things in the male who could produce the very fine hand axe. And it has persisted to this century, hand axe making of a very high order in New Guinea, I mean in a certain area of New Guinea where I've done some field work. But I would say on the question of fiction...
Dr. Dutton, could you hold that one through a short break here we've got to take? We'll come right back and pick it up. Thomas Wynn, if you could stick with us in Colorado Springs, and Dennis Dutton in Christchurch, New Zealand, author of the new book, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. Talking about sexual selection, here's that seductive Latin American classic, Siboney, behind me, sung by Raul Malo. Yeah. That sounds like something at work there in selection. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about art and evolution. My guest today says the human love of art is Darwinian. Dennis Dutton's new book is The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. He joins us from Christchurch, New Zealand today. We've also been joined from Colorado Springs for a few more minutes by Thomas Wynn, archaeologist and professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado. Dennis Tutton, Thomas Wynn had raised the question about your representation of the role maybe of fiction in human evolution, saying that evidence for storytelling fiction goes back only 50,000 years, and of course we're talking on a much grander scale than that. How do you square those?
Well, I mean, I would say that one of the things we've always got to remember is that archaeology is the science that studies things that were hard enough to survive a million or 500,000 or 100,000 years. So we actually don't have much, if you go back farther than 100,000 years, evidence of body painting. We don't have evidence of jokes. We don't have evidence of poetry. We don't have much evidence of dancing. And yet, I find it hard to believe that the hominid ancestors or the human beings who were making hand axes didn't have some other kind of intellectual life that went along with it. And just because we don't know about it doesn't mean that we have to sort of see things as, you know, I suppose, you know, really when you think about it, there is, and Tom Wynn might even agree with me on this, a tendency that we get from alley-oop cartoons and from the Flintstones and from New Yorker cartoons. Practically every issue has some stupid caveman with animal skins around him and a big club saying something cute. These people were smart. These people survived. These people, at a certain point in time had sewn clothing. They were ornamenting their bodies. I think they were telling stories. I'm very interested in what would have been the prehistory of humor, because I think the ability to take a disinterested view of art is connected with the ability to take an ironic view of any situation. And of course, human beings are not only an art-making species, they're a joke-telling species. I see that as crucial. And we don't always have to always be talking about music and dance and Beethoven and so forth. I mean, there's a great stream here. But the hand axe argument, I find, as Tom Wynn has given it, absolutely compelling. I have it in the book. But I just think that there was probably a richer intellectual and emotional life that went on with those hand axes than we'll ever have any record of.
Tom Wynn, you're our scientist. Are you willing to entertain the idea that, you know, beyond the record of rock and stone, even if we have no record beyond 50,000 years, that maybe it was in the evolutionary stew?
Well, I think I've been trained to be a skeptic in many senses, and many of my critics have argued that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. It's something I hear a lot, but at some point, absence of evidence is absence of evidence, and I think that, and I agree with Dr. Dutton, that we do tend to undersell our Pleistocene ancestors very seriously by painting them as inept, stupid, clumsy individuals. And I agree with him that they had an intellectual life beyond what we see in the stone tools. But where I am a little bit more skeptical is trying to then infer things like, you know, fictional storytelling or narrative back at the time of Homo erectus making hand axes. My guess is that their cultural life was very different. And one of the hardest things for us as evolutionary scientists is try to paint a picture of that life that's not modern, but it's not like that of apes. And it is, in fact, very difficult to do. I agree with Dr. Dutton also that this question of humor is a very interesting one. My guess is, and several people agree with me, including Steve Mithen and my colleague Fred Coolidge, that our early ancestors probably did have a sense of humor. It may have been a little bit more Three Stooges than New Yorker kind of humor would be, my guess.
Yes.
And until relatively late. But I think that's an important element. So I don't have profound disagreements with Dr. Dutton on this. I think it's just a matter of where I am a little more conservative than he is.
Thomas Wynn, joining us from Colorado Springs, author of the forthcoming The Rise of Homo Sapiens. Professor Wynn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
A couple of references to the New Yorker. We've got a caller on that front. Harry in Burlington, Vermont. You're on the air, Harry.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I actually am a cartoonist and cover artist for The New Yorker, and I come from a family of... There are nine working artists in my family, and
It's like the Bach family, you know?
What's that?
I'd say it sounds to me like the J.S. Bach family. They were all musicians.
Well, we're all you know, we're not sort of Sunday painters. We all actually make livings as mostly a visual artist. My sister's a painter, and my brother's an artist, and so on and so forth. Mm. But the interesting thing has always been, the question for me has been, our grandparents had no artistic ability on either side of the family. Yet my father's an artist, you know, and all of his brothers are artists. We were able to, myself included, to sort of look at things at a very early age and tell how, if they were artistically beautiful, whether it was composition, color theory. I mean, I'm going back to probably maybe 8 or 9 years old. This is before I had any artistic training. Mm-hmm. Now, there's this argument of nurture and nature versus nature, but in our case, it seems like a visceral thing, like it was there very early on. And I want to know if the doctor can speak to that, because where did it come from? I went to art school, went on to these universities to study what makes a beautiful picture. Why is Van Gogh's paintings, why are they so beautiful? What makes them amazing? and I figured that stuff out, but yeah. If you go back as a child, I'll look at the back of a little beetle lying in the sidewalk, and I'll have this almost instinctual appreciation for the simplistic yet intricate beauty of that. I don't know where it comes from.
It's a great question. Philosopher Dutton, are you prepared to push your hypothesis all the way out here?
Yes, terrific question. You talk about your family. Let me answer with mine. Where did my intense interest in music start? And where does it come from? I have a brother who's a pianist. My siblings like music. Our father was a painter, but he had no musical sense at all. Our mother was a musician. You talk about seeing that beetle as a child and just having an intuitive sense. I found I had a phonographic memory. You know, I practically have the entire Western canon of music. Just, you know, I can drop the needle tests, as they used to call them when there were needles.
Name
rather
that
easily,
bit.
You know.
Name that bar.
Yeah. I think it's amazing the heritability, what the Darwinians would call the heritability of these abilities. They are not the same with people in general. They are wildly different, as our tastes are wildly different. The way they come up in families are amazing. I do wish I knew something about your grandparents and about their parents as well, because I think there might be other people there in that genetic line who do have the artistic abilities you're talking about. But there's no question in my mind that there are quite special talents that show up. You see this in tribal cultures. I've done work in New Guinea. And, you know, there will be two or three people in any village who are acknowledged by everybody as the village poet, as the best carver in the village, as the one who can dance the best, just intuitively, instinctively, without much training at all. And I think this is a fascinating part of the arts. And, of course, then when you get to the real outliers on the artistic bell curve, then you're up to Mozart and Jane Austen and Tolstoy and so forth, and Shakespeare. Those are truly extraordinary people, and you can't really draw much in way of conclusions with them. But, you know, that's part of the fascination of this whole idea that there's a genetic basis for art. It's wildly various in the human colony, so to speak.
Harry, how's it worked for you on the sexual selection front? Have the females of the species been throwing themselves at New Yorker cartoonists?
Well, I'm engaged now, so I'd like to take that question off the air.
Well, you're doing all right then. Good. Harry, thanks very much for calling. Let's go to Pontiac, Michigan, and Megan. Megan, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Duncan?
Yeah, yes. Dutton,
hi.
Yes.
Dutton.
Dutton,
where
yeah.
Where is he located? I'm sorry?
Yes, Dennis Dutton is with you from New Zealand. Yes,
from
Megan.
Christchurch, New Zealand. It's the middle of the night here. It's late summer. It's late summer, and it's very dark outside.
Well, I would like to, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm trying to find out where you are. Where is Christchurch? Is that in the north or the south?
That's in the South Island of New Zealand.
Okay. The reason I'm asking is because I actually applied for a Fulbright. I'm interested in working in New Zealand because I wanted to study the Maori community there because I'm an elementary art teacher. I'm also an artist, and I feel that in my educational setting, it's void of any real strong sense of community, in the sense that the arts are not elevated to any higher power. There's nothing in our community here.
Are you talking about in the United States, they're not elevated to a higher power?
Well, they're not elevated to a very important status in education. I feel like the elementary art program that I teach in doesn't emphasize the importance of how valuable visual communication is when learning art.
Megan, let me ask you that on this front of evolution, if I may, do you see a tendency toward the arts surging in your young students anyway? Something that would suggest whether they're prized and put on a pedestal or not, that it's part of the basic human kit?
It is a very important part of the human kit. The early childhood development is full of visual forms of communication, and they should be utilized in our schools so much more because they are developing their storytelling skills, their verbal skills, and they're trying to show that through symbolism, through various elements in art, line, color, shape. And my idea to study the Maori stem from their strong sense of those elements in art. Their art forms have a strong symbolic nature to them that indicate meaning, deeper meaning in their culture. And I think that the elements in our society aren't used for that purpose.
Megan, good luck with that. I hope you go straight there. Dennis Dutton, it brings me back to something you said just offhandedly earlier about evolution stopping 10,000 years ago or so. I mean, I wonder if it ever really stops, and if the art instinct is at play, if art is part of evolution, what about now? When you look around, do you still see it? You know, can you picture it engaged in some long arc of human evolution now?
Well, I mean, it depends on whether or not you view evolution as having stopped. There are people who are claiming that evolution is actually still going on in the human sphere, and it's actually going faster than it went in human prehistory. I don't think that we can in our lifetimes see anything like evolutionary movements in something like the arts. And the only way, of course, the arts can change in the future is if there is some kind of differential reproductive rate of artists or of artists of a certain kind or having a certain kind of taste with the rest of the population. And I don't see that. I mean, I don't see artists reproducing more or particularly reproducing less than anyone else just looking around. So I wouldn't expect any changes in artistic tastes. The changes would have had to happen over, as I say, this extremely long period of the Pleistocene, and to give Tom Wynn his due, probably in the last 10% of the Pleistocene was where most of the changes would have happened, which had bearing on aesthetic taste. But, you know, the arts are going to change. They will change anyway. Whether our basic hardwired tastes will change, well, that's another question.
Of course, we're still on that long arc of time. If you step back from it, you've got this wonderful exchange in your book, Professor Dutton, from the movie The African Queen, where Humphrey Bogart is trying to excuse his drinking by telling Katharine Hepburn, Rose Sayer in the film, that it's only human nature. And his retort, or her retort, Katharine Hepburn's retort, Rose's retort in the movie is, "Nature, Mr. Allnut, is what we are put in this world to rise above."
I think that takes me back to one of the other caller's questions, the question that that the other Tom had earlier. I am not arguing in this book. This book has a lot to do with the high arts. It goes all the way down to The Simpsons and Ren and Stimpy and things that I particularly like in the lower arts, if you want to call them that, or the popular arts. What we need is a view of evolution as it affects all of the arts, but not simply to reduce the arts to our basic fundamental desires, any more than you want to reduce all food to sugar and fat. Now, that's not the issue. The issue is how do we as human beings transcend our own animal selves and create this huge, glorious, glittering world, which is art and music and the ballet and, I love it, the opera. You know, what is it about human beings that allows us to stand above our nature and create the deepest, most sublime works which can move us in the ways that they do? That, I think, is a serious question for evolutionary aesthetics. And you know, I think mine is the first book which is trying actually to give a direct answer to that question. Maybe this is the Pleistocene of Darwinian aesthetics, and my book is the first scribbling on a cave wall. But I think it's going to go somewhere.
Yeah, what Clive Bell calls the cold white peaks of art, and you celebrate there, of course, also the Iliad and Bruegel's Hunters in the Snow and King Lear and the Schubert's Winterreise of Van Gogh's Starry Night, all those. But I guess once you put the word evolution on, then you also tie them to our animal selves. I mean, they are the creation of our animal selves.
Sure. I mean, in the same, but I mean, no more than all of human love, our love of our own children, is somehow tied to evolution. That doesn't mean that I'm no more than an ape, but certainly my love of my children is in some ways an animal instinct. But that doesn't mean it's not admirable and we shouldn't have more of it.
Even sublime. Dennis Dutton's new book is The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. He joined us today from Christchurch, New Zealand. Dennis Dutton, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say, Tom, there is a website called theartinstinct.com. It has information about the book.
Check it out. We'll go out with Tuvan throat singing, one of the oldest forms of music. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.